Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
It's not working out at all. Let's do something
and welcome to Infinite Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? Infinite Tennis is the guy who flies to the net in one bound. Infinite Tennis remembers when you could win tennis matches without hitting a lot of ground strokes. Today's guest has been a powerful net rusher for many years and dominated Northern California open-level play. He's also a great coach and worked with a lot of top players who came from the Central Valley of California, more specifically Modesto. Mark Fairchild is going to tell us about his career, his legendary influences, and a teaser of his Six Zones of Doubles presentation that he's currently presenting around the country. We are going to a commercial, and when we come back, we're going to bring Mark on the show. If you have any questions for this guest or any future guests, you can email me at infinitetennis8@gmail.com, infinitetennis8@gmail.com.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. Hello, Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm excited to be on your show, Bill.
Excellent, excellent. Glad to hear that. So how are you doing today?
Great. It's another warm day here in Modesto.
Yeah, and we have fog where I am because that's been what we do this summer is have fog in the morning until about 10, which is kind of nice. So, Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself and where did you grow up and what and your playing career. How did that all transpire?
Well, I actually grew up in a small beach town called La Selva Beach, which is in Santa Cruz County by Aptos. I actually didn't play too much tennis growing up. I was more of a beach kid, but I went to Aptos High and was lucky enough to belong to Seascape Racquet Club, which is a great tennis club in by the water. And I went to University of Pacific and played number one there, but I really didn't play many tournaments. I didn't even play my first tournament until I was 17, but I really, once I got the passion, really played a lot of tennis. And then after college, I was lucky enough to be on the tour for a while where I played for a few years and almost got up to about 500 in the world in singles and almost 200 in doubles, and then was lucky enough at 24 years old to get a director of tennis job at Marina Yacht and Tennis Club in Stockton. And then
wow.
from then on, I've been teaching for a long time. In the last 20 years, I've been teaching at Modesto Racquet Club in Modesto and love every minute of it.
That's great. So tell us about some of the influential coaches that you've run into, and what were, in a nutshell, what were some of the things that you gained from them?
Well, I was very lucky at Seascape Racquet Club. I really had three influential coaches. The first one was Henry Kamakana, who was our pro, who's a fantastic coach. Second
yeah.
one was Bob Hansen, who was at UC Santa Cruz, who's maybe one of the best ever collegiate coaches. And then the third one, after I left, went to college, Henry went on to Los Altos. I had Mark Elliott, who come to Seascape, who coached a lot of the, not only the best people in Northern California, best players in the world. He had Matt Anger, Greg Holmes, and all of them were very different and unique, but all of them had certain traits I was looking for from a coach. They all played at Wimbledon. They all were ranked number one in NorCal and Men's Open, and they all could play tennis still, which was great because I got to be lucky enough to play with them doubles in tournaments, and they all had great students and were so positive that it really made a difference in my playing ability, but also made a huge influence on me when I became a coach also to try to do a lot of the same things they did.
That's great. Hey, can I do my Henry Kamakana impression?
Sure.
I think you might like it. Okay, how about this? How about a forehand volley with a backhand grip? I remember,
well,
I'll never forget the presentation that he did on volleying, and my understanding about Henry is even getting up in years that there were, you know, open-level guys that couldn't get the ball through him at the net.
Oh, he's an amazing person. I mean, he started every lesson with volleys or slices, and I mean, he started, that's how he warmed up for matches. He always started the net, which drew most people start at the baseline when they start the warm-up. He would always start at the net and was always talking about forehand slices, and I mean volleys and slices. And I don't know if you know Michael Jessup was one of his students, and so Michael and I always get together and we talk about Henry's stories because he was such a great influence and probably the best volley teacher in Northern California.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, definitely. I think the thing I like about him especially is that you see volleying as artwork with him. And, you know, because so many people get rigid with the way, with the grips and the footwork, and you lose out on the spontaneity of you know, hitting a crazy shot behind you and having to angle it the other way or whatnot. So, yeah, he really opened it up that way. So talk about Bob Hansen. What would you say is the number one influence that you got from him?
Well, the one thing about Bob Hansen, I think people understand, he never gets what we call an elite player in nowadays, like a five-star, four-star, three-star junior when they come into college. He has never even had a three-star player ever come to him in school. That shows you how great a teacher is. He's the player that really helped me because I was always pretty good athletically. He teaches you how to use your athletic ability to become a better tennis player. And he used my athletic ability to learn how to get to the net better. I mean, he understood that I was very good at the net, had great reflexes, and he figured out the athletic skills-wise how for me to be able to get there to be able to win a lot of matches.
Yeah, that's excellent. And then, let's see, who's the third guy? Because you said
Mark Elliott.
Okay, yeah, so what about him? What was the main influence from him?
Well, he really helped me on a couple things. My serve became much stronger when I worked with him. But he was so good at what I call learning how to strike exactly where you want to on the tennis racket. Where on the strings do you need to make contact with the ball? He was very good at that, and Matt Ng or Greg Holmes were probably two of his greatest students who were very good at ground strokes, and he really helped me understand how to strike the ball on the ground strokes. Where do you want to make contact? How do you want to make your swing more smooth and efficient in being able to do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, That's great. So now I know that you crossed paths with Fred Earle, who, you know, was very influential for me and a lot of pros in the Central Valley and a lot of great players. What about Fred? I mean, he's such a great guy and such a great coach. What was that like working alongside him?
Well, when I came to Modesto Racquet Club, Fred and Fritz Earle had sold the club to Al Brenda and his family. So I've worked for the Brenda family for over 21 years. But Fred was with us. He was part of the staff for about a year and a half before he passed away. But unlike a lot of people, I had a great respect for Fred. So we would sit down and have lunch once a week and talk tennis for about an hour. And you want to talk about some passionate discussions. He is one of the most passionate people I've ever seen on the game of tennis. And he was very much into the balance and the striking of the ball. And I don't think a lot of people know that he was best friends with Tom Stowe, who might have been the greatest tennis teacher of all time. And so we had some amazing discussions, and I was more into learning how to be successful in the game of tennis. I was more into what do you need to do strategically in the game of tennis. So we would have some amazing discussions on what is more important, where you hit the ball, what type of swing do you have, footwork. And we'd go all over the place, but it was so much fun for a year, year and a half, just talking tennis with Fred. He's just an amazing person and an amazing coach, not only in tennis, but I don't think a lot of people know that at MJC he coached golf, he coached track and field, basketball and football, and some people say he was a better track coach and a better basketball coach than even a tennis coach.
That's really truly amazing, because I think that, and that underlines the point that if you're a great coach, it has so much to do with your understanding of movement and you know, an eye for taking advantage of opportunities that exist, you know. So that's really interesting. It's funny, my daughter's a swimmer, and so every once in a while I'll be watching the swim team, and I notice a kid not doing so great, so I go over to the coach, and I'm like, you know, it looks like so-and-so's doing this, you know, and they need to do it a little different. He's like, oh, yeah, you're right. So I think it's true that if, you know, when you've got that coaching, you can really observe things in different people in different sports and find areas of improvement. That's interesting. You know, the other thing about Fred was that he was a master hypnotist. And when we were out to lunch, we were talking about hypnotism in coaching. And he said that you don't have to induce someone into a trance in order to use the power of suggestion.
Yes.
And I thought that was major. That was so big, because now on a daily basis in every single lesson, I'm using the power of suggestion of, hey, why don't you try this? And then the player tries it, but they don't realize it's because of the power of suggestion that they're doing that. So I think if more coaches understood the power of the fact that your players come to you and they trust you and they're highly suggestible, that you can count on that.
I forgot. But that was good you talked about that. I forgot all about it. He had so many, the whole Earl family was so good at whatever they did. They had a lot of different things. They were also getting to juggling and some other things, so that's interesting you remember that.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever seen him use using hypnotism and or other sort of out there kind of techniques on the court?
Well, he had a mirror on the side of his court, and so everybody could always see what they were trying to do. He always had a mirror so people could look into the mirror and see how their stroke was, so which was fascinating. I still haven't seen another person ever that teaches that had a mirror on their court. So he was very good, and, I mean, he had a lot of different techniques, but I've never seen him hypnotize anybody, but he did use power suggestion in a lot of different ways with his students.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, it's funny. That's crazy, the mirror thing, because that's faster than video.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, you're seeing what you're doing like right now while you're doing it. That's amazing. I might go get myself a big mirror and put it on my court.
So, yeah. And that's first question people are going, what is that mirror for? And Ed, Fred would say, you'll find out here in a couple minutes.
That's good. All right, so let's shift gears here. I want you to give us a little something on the six zones of doubles. I mean, I know that you're going to be speaking tomorrow, in fact, and I don't want you to give away the whole presentation, but, you know, what's something, because the listenership of this show is pretty sophisticated. So, you know, they know a lot of the standard doubles, you know, strategies and whatnot. So what's kind of a subtlety that a high-level junior or, you know, a very accomplished coach, what can you give them that's going to help them with one little piece?
Well, the six zones are basically understanding what has changed in the game of tennis. Technology with the rackets, the stringing, the evolution of teaching is just amazing here in the last 10, 15 years that the game has become almost like an extreme game with so much power, spin. It just teaches that the court is growing longer and wider every second the game is being produced with technology, that you have to understand all the different zones in the game of tennis to be successful. And before, it used to be you needed just to get to the net to be successful in doubles. And for more advanced, especially the more advanced you get in the game of doubles, you need two things really to be effective. You need amazing reflexes when you're up close to the net, which is more like a zone one, just understanding how important it is to teach the reflex part of the game. And then the second thing that I think people understand about doubles, the better you get, the more you have to be better behind the baseline, and understanding how to play behind the baseline in singles or doubles is imperative right now in the game of tennis.
Okay, so you mean essentially handling lobs and lobbing back and hitting balls, so hitting from back there and making sure you're not hitting to a net person.
That's the thing that people understand, the depth of the game and how far back. And you see, hitting lobs is what I would call more of a classic style from behind the baseline. The players nowadays, the great doubles players or modern players who can still be 10, 15 feet behind the baseline and do something very offensive with the ball to set up their partner. And it's just learning how to play from behind the baseline with more topspin, with more power, with more slice is going to be a huge ingredient in you being successful in the game of doubles as you get more advanced.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is even if you're in a disadvantageous position and you're way behind the baseline, you're still going to try to kind of rip a topspin, short cross court kind of a thing?
Or some of the things. If you look at the number one women's team in the world, which I saw in Indian Wells, and Sarah Rani and Vinci, they play almost half the match from behind the baseline. And they're the number one doubles teams in the world in ladies. And they're able to do so much thing, what I call modern-style doubles. And they can hit topspin. And a lot of times they'll have what I call one up, one back. And they'll have one person behind the baseline hitting some truly remarkable topspin shots that sets up the other net person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember seeing St. Mary's coach played on the tour. Can't think of his name. Pardon me?
Lisa Alapaz? Or is it Michael Wayman?
Michael Wayman was talking about, you know, this a great new play where the returner just hammers the net person on the serving team, and then the net man's looking for a floating reply so he can come poach that. I thought that was very interesting because it was a different kind of a thing. And I actually got some high school kids who could do that. You know, it's interesting how the game's evolving. So I guess people are going to have to come, you know, bring you to their club and get the rest of that, or, you know, check out the specialty course. Is that in Tiburon tomorrow, right?
Yeah, Tiburon Peninsula Club. Very excited to be presenting this course. I did last time I presented this course was actually at the Midwest High School Coaches Conference in Detroit, Michigan. And I really like this course because it teaches what I think is changing the game of doubles. And it depends on levels, as you said. There's, you know, we have Grand Dame ladies matches, you have junior matches, you have USTA teams, and so understanding the different levels of doubles and how to be effective.
So there's something for everybody. Everybody's going to have something they can take away from that. Okay, that's great. So let's go to a commercial, and then when we come back, then we're going to get into some advice. What advice do you have for coaches, parents, and players through the junior tennis years so that they can excel? So here we go to a commercial, and we'll be right back.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, welcome back. So, Mark, you know, this is one of my standard questions that I like to ask, and it's amazing to me how similar all the answers are. So let's see if you can stretch the boundaries. So what advice would you give to coaches as they help their players to negotiate the junior tennis landscape? Prepare for the highest levels of play?
Well, I'm probably going to be a little different on this answer than most because I didn't even play my first tournament until I was 17 years old. And so I like the word you use, negotiate junior tennis. I think the key is you want to negotiate the high levels of tennis. And I'm a very patient coach and kind of understand that the game of tennis really evolves around 16 to 19 years old. And it's important to understand how to keep progressing in the game. I think too many coaches, players, and parents get too caught up in junior tennis. And it's a very high-stakes game, and people get so involved in to being successful as a junior tennis player that they never become successful as a highly level tennis player. And so you have to be very patient in what's going on. And nowadays with junior tennis, especially with starting with all the balls and transition balls and everything, which is great for the game of tennis, it even lands more people in the junior tennis, and it just feels like people are just trying to survive junior tennis. And what I see a lot of times is a lot of great junior tennis players that just aren't able to succeed at the higher levels.
Yeah, that's interesting. I heard a stat, and I'm not sure how reliable this is, but it can't be far off. They said that not one boys 12's number one nationally ranked player has ever become a top 100 pro.
That is an interesting stat. Since I started teaching tennis, which was in 1986, there's only been in Northern California one player ever that was ranked number one in 12s that ended up ranked number one in 18s.
Yeah.
And it was Ryan Walters from Stanford. That's only one player for the last over 25 years that when they were ranked number one in 12s was able to be still ranked number one in 18s in Northern California.
Yeah, and so the point here I'm getting is don't train the kids to be successful so much in the 12s and the 14s, but teach them the complete game that will all come together when they're 16, 17, 18, so that they'll be able to win some points at the net, and they'll be able to play good doubles, and they'll be able to have a variety of shots, a complete tool set.
Yeah, absolutely correct. That's the key, being able to be successful as you gain towards the higher levels. You need to have a complete tool set, as you say, and be able to do all the different things. And I also feel like when you get emotionally attached to junior tennis, it takes so much out of you mentally, the parent and the player, that they just don't have anything left when they get to the higher levels.
You know, that's a great word you use, attached, because I was just working with my best junior, and I have him reading Inner Tennis, Playing the Game, which is the second book by Galway, and it's way better. It's really practical. And the word attached and detached came up. And I thought, that's very interesting, because if you become detached, then you're a lot more clinical in what you're doing, and you're a lot more strategic, and you can probably take losing a little bit better, mm-hmm. because you're working on becoming an 18 and under player.
Yes.
But if you're attached, to it, then it has too much meaning, and then all those losses sort of mount up on you, and you get discouraged.
Yes, very much, and I think the attached part is also, what is the goal, to be a great junior player, or is it attached to become a great tennis player? And I think a lot of times it's just the emotional side for especially the parent. I think the parent almost gets into it a little more than the actual junior a lot of times, and it becomes very difficult for the junior to understand how to keep progressing as a tennis player.
Yeah, that's great. So that was kind of the catch-all answer for coaches, parents, and players, all right? Now, what would you have, now that you're in junior tennis and you're doing it, what advice would you give to parents so that they can avoid getting so attached? What should they do?
They should have I think one of the first things to worry about is how good your junior is. I think the biggest issue is when they actually get pretty good, like for Northern California around top 20 or closer, then they really want to go to nationals. And nationals are great, and it's a great experience in understanding how to play in front of a lot of people and handling a lot of exposure. But the key is they almost, progress, do over-progression towards just trying to make nationals instead of keep progressing as a full tennis player. And I almost feel they overwork the junior for that goal when they're physically not ready for it, compared to waiting out and being a little bit more transitioned towards 17, 18, 19 years old. Is the junior now filling into their body? Are they able to transform and be able to do so many more things athletically on the tennis court, that it's very difficult to teach parents in that situation that that's more the goal than the goal of, I think a parent thinks if their kids are going to make nationals that they're really on their way to becoming a great player. But really, unless it's nationals and 18s, there's still a long way to go athletically and physically for the player to become good.
Yeah. You know, an example of that is I've got a kid I'm working with, and he has some incredibly high goals, and he's very hardworking. And so, you know, we calculated the 10 years and the 10,000 hours, and this summer we had him on the court. He was on the court for about 25 hours a week. We discovered that 25 hours was wearing him down, and so he wasn't quite performing as well in the tournament. So we took a look at that. Within a couple of weeks, we saw that, and we went, all right, you know what, we're gonna cut back on this. So you're not going to come to me for 3 hours and then go play for two more hours in the afternoon. You got to chill. You know. So we got him to right about 20 hours, and now he's doing fine. So,
yeah.
You know, I think I agree with you that, and he's 13 years old, and it's a little young for him to take on that big workload. So now, you know, to players, because, you know, Joel Drucker was on the show recently, and he was fantastic. He had some great opinions and all that. And his point was, players develop themselves. You know, if the player wants it, the player's going to do it, and they'll convince their parents and their coaches to work with them. You know, a great example of that is Andy Roddick. I mean, that guy was so driven, right? And so if it's in the if it was all in the player's hands, what would you tell the player that they should do to influence their coaches and parents?
That's an interesting point. Now, that depends on if it was all in the player's hands, and there is where you have probably the most understanding of who is going to be successful, because My parents hardly ever watched me play a match. I was all driven by myself, just like you said. And I have a very good student who's going to help me out tomorrow when I'm in Tiburon, and he's completely driven by himself. He doesn't need any parents or family support. And a lot of times, if the kid's driven, they will come to their coach to find out what is the progressions and everything on that situation. I think the key thing that you find out a lot about tennis is not that the players ask that question. The players let their parents make those decisions for them, or they're in a family structure where it is made for them. And so I found that as that would be an interesting thing that you just discussed, whether if we could have, let's say, 40-50% more of our players make the decisions themselves on what they should be able to do for tennis, it would be great to see how their success rate would be. And it would be very interesting. But I see majority of kids, or the juniors, not having that ability to make those decisions themselves.
Yeah. Well, were you there for Lansdorf when he came to Stanford?
No, I missed that.
Oh, man. Okay, so I'm going to do my Robert Lansdorf impression now. All right, so I get this email from a Russian kid, and he says, "Hey, coach, Robert, I want to hit the two-handed backhand, but my coach wants me to hit one-handed. What should I do?" So I told him, "Fire your coach." You know, I love that. I love that because, you know what? If the kid wants to hit one-handed, let him hit one-handed. Now, as a coach, yeah, you recommend to him, hey, you know what? It's not working for you. You know, here, let's look at your one-hander. Let's look at your two-hander. You decide. All right, so you like your horrible one-hander. Go ahead and lose, and then let me know when you're ready to change.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's a great example of what I'm saying is that the fact I'm surprised that it even went to from a player to a coach. It usually just ends with a parent in that situation. So it's I find that fascinating, you know, that if the players, I feel they need to be really comfortable on the court as a junior player, whatever tennis player, they need to be comfortable in what they do. And so that makes them become more successful in that situation.
Yeah, and, you know, it's because part of it's self-expression. Because, I mean, and you're a great example of that, you know, because the Mark Fairchild game, everybody knows what it is, and everybody's ready to feel the pain, you know. It's like Mark's going to fly to the net, you know, and he'll be there before you can do anything about it, you know. So you were able to express yourself and your athleticism in the way you played, you know, whereas, you know, if you're Nadal and you got the 22-inch pythons, then you can rip huge topspin to people's backhands all day long. But if you're 5'4 and 115 pounds soaking wet, then you probably ought not to try to play like Nadal.
Yeah, and that's that's kind of what Bob Hansen, your thought process. Bob Hansen tried to use the athletic abilities of the tennis player to find a style of play that suited their comfort level. And it really makes a huge difference in how far a player can evolve if they can fit the athletic ability to the style of play that can make them very comfortable. Then they usually progress very quickly.
Yep. Okay, good. So let's shift gears here. Let's talk about getting to the net. And what I want to do is I want to throw some ideas at you, and then you let me know what has merit, what's the downside of it, or maybe redirect me here. All right, so the first one is you can still come in on a standard approach shot, but now it's more important for the approach to be low than it is for it to be deep. What do you think of that?
That's part of the six zones that you just talked about. A lot of what you say, it's not necessarily needs to be low. It has to make the player move out of the zone they're standing in. And what you kind of expressed was most players hit a ball deep now as their approach. Well, that won't work if the person's standing like Nadal 10, 15 feet behind the baseline, because they're so far behind the baseline, the depth doesn't matter. And if you, I'd like the word you said, low. If you notice nowadays, there's more drop shots hit nowadays than in the last 10 to 15 years because the opponents play so far back. And to come to the net is really to maneuver the opponent away from the zone they're standing in. And it could be topspin, it could be a slice, it could be a drop shot, it could be a lot of different shots. But that's the way you need to be able to come to the net. You can't just hit an approach shot and let the person hit the passing shot from the same zone they're standing in, or you will probably get passed.
Well, and thank goodness for those drop shots, because then now we probably don't have to worry about seeing a 7-foot-tall tennis player. The drop shots especially made it more difficult for those really big guys. So they are not quite marching up the ranks like they were by just hitting one serve, you know. Anyway, so that's interesting. So, yeah, I appreciate the redirect on that one. Now, recently Alan Fox was on the show, and he was talking about how in that Nadal-Djokovic-French final that if Djokovic had just snuck into the net a little bit behind some high looming shots to Nadal's backhand, that, you know, he might have been able to sneak in and hit a couple of volleys, that could have turned that match. So what do you think about using the really big looping shot to the backhand and kind of just reading?
I think that's a great play. And one of the things I really like what Hank Pfister does in the Hank Pfister is a great pro who was a real good net player also on understanding what needs to happen in the game of tennis. And he says if you can get that ball with a lot of pace and spin to someone's backhand, it is very hard for them to redirect passing shots to pass you. And Djokovic is one of the best players in hitting the ball hard and being able to get in that. And what I remember from the French match, I actually think, as Alan said, Djokovic had him. I felt he just got a little bit tight and a little bit, conservative in the fifth set, and that's why he lost. And it's just, you know, if he came to the net and kept hitting out on the ground strokes, I think he should have won that match.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess when you're playing Nadal, you know, I mean, Nadal's the greatest player on clay ever. Right? I mean, kind of hard to argue with that. All right, so now how about a very short chip that lands a few feet inside the service line?
That is a great play. That is, you're right on that one. That's a great play when the person's standing far behind the baseline. And if you watch junior tennis, people understand most errors juniors make are not behind the baseline. It is their transition game with balls inside the baseline. Most players, if you chart a junior match and you watch where they make their ground stroke errors, most of them are inside the baseline, not behind the baseline. And so because they don't practice the transition part. So anything short and low to a side is a very difficult ball for people who like to play far behind the baseline.
Well, and then, you know, that's interesting because I think that's part of the power of kind of that Spanish X drill thing, you know, where you toss balls backwards and forwards and get people moving up and back so they can move forward and make that shot. So what are some other sneaky ways to get to the net that can be effective?
Well, nowadays I'm amazed at some of the players, and this was with Andy Roddick and my partner's name's Johnny Tilakainen, and his brother teaches Jerzy Janowicz, who's unbelievable monster serve. And one thing we're discussing with his coach, Kimi Tilakainen, is the fact that Jerzy's serve is so huge that the person can just block it back, and he doesn't serve in volley. You know, when they're only able to block back the ball and just get in the middle of court, that's when you should be able to come in. And so if you have a big serve, you should have the ability to serve and volley. And if you watch the semifinal in Wimbledon, Murray just started chipping every return and just getting in the court, and Jerzy should have come in and serve and volleyed a lot of times. So that's one way to do it. Another one is just the recognition, and I mean Roger Federer in his prime was better than anybody else at recognizing when the ball is floating in the air and would be able to come in and take it out of there. And that's just being able to recognize when a person's going to hit a moon ball or a soft slice high ball to be defending the court, and people know how to come in and volley it, they can knock it off for a winner.
Well, you know, and this reminds me of a presentation you gave a couple of years ago where you were talking about kind of the field position of tennis and how when you recognize that you've hit a deep ball to your opponent, then that's the time to jump inside the court by about 2 or 3 feet and really read and look for that opportunity to move forward more. So, you know, I've been working with this kid who's 13, and we've been working on that a lot, and it's going to take a little while, but we're starting now, and by the time he's 18, for sure he's going to be able to jump in there. So thank you for that. That was a few years ago, but yeah, I mean, so you have to train your instincts on that because of the decision-making necessary.
Yes, that's the part of the game that becomes difficult to learn is the recognition skills, as you say, and it takes a lot of training over, as I say, probably 15 to 19 years old is where a lot of that training skills have to be put into place.
Yeah, and you also have to be not afraid to make mistakes. You know, I think that ground strokers are like accountants, and volley players are more artistic. And you don't worry about a bad brush stroke, you know, because you can just take the paint and redo it. But, you know, you gotta take some risks and have some calculated risks. But I hear people use the word consistent. I need to be more consistent. But nobody ever uses the word consistent and makes themselves feel better about it. They're always beating themselves up. You know, so part of the thing is like you look at a Federer, and he's a risk taker, and he's not afraid to make ugly errors. I mean, he'll make 4 or 5 ugly errors in a 5-set match for sure.
Yes. I like that you said that about accountants. That's a very good point of where tennis is going. Everybody's more critical of their errors. And there's two ways of thoughts. Mark Weir is my practice partner. He's a great player here in Modesto. We've played for over 30 years. He is what I would call an accountant, does not want to make one error. Well, my feeling on the game of tennis is, how good is your game? How many errors can you make your opponent create? Can you create errors that your opponent are going to make so it's easier for you to win, so you don't have to hit too many winners? And it's learning how to have a style of play that creates errors from your opponent. And the more you can always make them feel pressure that you're coming in makes them have to take more risks, which usually produce errors.
Yeah, and you know that's part of. I mean, that's what Brad Gilbert did with Andre Agassi, because Agassi was always trying to hit the fastest winner of all time. He was looking for the 120 mile an hour forehand, and then Gilbert said, no, you don't have to do that. Just consistently keep that ball so deep and so hard that nobody can do anything but make a mistake.
Yes.
So, all right. So now let's talk about the USPTA. I know that you've heard the election results, and so what do you think about the current direction of the USPTA at this time? Where are we headed?
I'd rather you take it into more of a little different detail than just USPTA, because there's the PTR also. I'm more concerned about where is the tennis teaching professional headed. I think we're at a major crossroads now as anybody who is a tennis teaching professional who teaches instruction in the game of tennis. I'm very concerned about what is happening lately. And for an example, I'm just going to take golf. Golf, you have the United States Golf Association and you have the Professional Golf Association. And I think the way things are done in golf are truly remarkable, and it's where it should go in tennis. The Professional Golf Association is in charge of instruction, in charge of tournaments, and in charge of the high level of play, and they are very successful with that. And then any job opening in golf, you have to be a PGA certified professional to get that job. Well, in tennis, I think our major issue is we haven't had at the national level at either PTR or USPTA a person in place that understands how important it is for the tennis teaching professional to make it more financially and viable for people to want to join this profession. And right now, the USTA is in a much better financial situation than either of the teaching organizations. And so it's an interesting thing just talking to tennis teaching professionals throughout the country that I think what's happened in the direction, most of the tennis teaching professionals, and I'm not on this opinion, believe that USTA should be in charge of what happens in the game of tennis. You know, they're already in charge of the tournaments because neither association, teaching-wise, runs any tournaments. They're in charge of high performance. But we are right now still in charge of tennis teaching instruction. It's amazing how most pros feel that way. And myself, I feel that our associations, our teaching associations, need to take a huge step in taking their own entity and working on it. We should be more involved in high performance. We should be definitely in charge of all instruction, and we should be starting to run our own tournaments ourselves. And It's amazing that I feel there's more people on with the USTA right now than understanding what us as tennis teaching professionals need to become a more viable profession.
Yeah, that's great, and I that inspires me because I'm actually working on the possibility of developing some yellow ball tournaments for 10 and under, yellow ball, green ball, and having them kind of like a little Mo type of structure because I think that if we don't have our most talented kids, our top 1% kids, we're training with the yellow balls early enough that we're actually putting our top 1% in danger. Now, people might disagree with that, but if there's no outlet for them, then we might find out the hard way. You know?
And I like the way you said that. That's what I see. There's so many amazing tennis teaching professionals throughout the country that are doing kind of their own little thing in our profession, but we haven't organized as a group well enough yet to take over a lot of what the standards of tennis should be in this country. And I think that's what's kind of happened. We have a lot of individual teaching professionals doing their thing, but we haven't organized well enough as a tennis teaching professional organization to make that successful.
What do you think is standing in the way of that? What prevents that? What's to overcome?
Well, the biggest thing, because I went on the national board for USPTA probably about 11, 12 years ago, and that was the time that we needed to do. Unfortunately, financially, what has happened, and this is basically what you're saying, is a financially difficult situation. In the last 10 to 12 years, USPTA and PTR aren't doing as well financially, and USTA is 20 to 30 times stronger financially now. And so that's the big concern with a lot of professionals, that financially we're just not in a situation to try to do more things or even have the temptation of trying to be in charge of more things in tennis in this country. And I think that's the number one thing, is financially difficulty right now.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate you sharing that, and I think that that's an interesting perspective because I like the answer better than my original question. So, tell us a little-known fact about Mark Fairchild. What's something that people don't know about you?
Well, a couple things. The first thing is my wife and I absolutely love NASCAR. My wife's a NASCAR junkie. We watch NASCAR races all the time, and we actually go to a lot of NASCAR races, which is very unusual for tennis pros. I don't see very many tennis pros out at the NASCAR races.
Well, I'm a NASCAR fan, too. I like Ricky Bobby a lot.
Yes, a lot of people do.
Yeah.
One of the favorite movies.
What's your race strategy today, Ricky Bobby? Go fast. Turn left, slow down. Okay, So, all right, now it's time for the hot seat, and don't worry, it's not going to be embarrassing. All right, the category, football, Raiders or Niners?
Raiders.
Music, Bieber or Beyonce?
Beyonce.
Yeah, because she's better looking, I'm sure. Okay, baseball, Giants or Yankees?
Giants.
Music, Hendrix or Elvis?
That's a tough one. I'll go with Hendrix.
Okay. Oh, awesome. All right. Best of all time, Federer or Nadal?
Federer.
Best grips, Western, Eastern, Semi-Western, or all of the above?
Great question. For right now, I would say all of the above.
Okay. Volley grips, true or false, hold the exact same grip for forehand or backhand volley?
False.
Movies, Apocalypse Now or Monsters, Inc.?
Monsters, Inc.
One or two word answer. Most essential element of a champion.
Addicted to winning.
That's three words. You lose.
I'm
okay.
Sorry. I couldn't think
Mark,
of those.
Yeah, you had it. You had it nailed, and then now you don't get the $10,000. I'm so sorry.
Okay.
So thanks, Mark, for all that. And how would you, if you had to sum up this discussion, how would you sum this whole thing up?
I think the best thing I loved about the discussion was the variety of topics that can come in the game of tennis. And that's what makes tennis so much fun. There's especially right now, I find tennis more exciting than ever before because there's so many different things you have to learn about the game of tennis and all the different aspects of the game of tennis that it makes it so exciting to play and to be a part of. And I just enjoyed all the different variety of questions that you asked today.
Great. Thank you. So thank you. And now how can people contact you if they want coaching or if they would like to have you come out and present on Six Zones or some of your other topics?
Well, they could do it in many ways. I mean, you could call always the Brenda Athletic Clubs, which is area code 209-571-CLUB. But my email address is markmfrc@all.com. And my cell number is area code 209-765-0815, and you can always get a hold of me, and I'll give you a quick reply whenever you give me a call or email me.
Terrific. All right, so thanks for coming on, and have a great day. Be sure to share this with all your friends. Take care.
Thanks, Bill. I had a great time.
All right, excellent. Thank you very much. All right, as always, thank you to those who've listened to past shows. We've got quite a few episodes that are there. If you're on vacation, because it's August right now, I don't know when you're listening to this, but be sure to download all the podcasts and listen to them while relaxing in the sun with a cold beverage and soak up the knowledge. All right, now, this is a very important announcement for all tennis professionals, right? Go to playtennis.com. Are you listed there? If not, you need to be. This week, the U.S. Open will be doing it. At the U.S. Open, there's going to be a huge rollout of playtennis.com, and you want to make sure that you and your programs are listed there because I guarantee you your local competitors are listed. So this is a massive effort by the TIA, and you want to get on board. If you or your programs are not listed, contact me right away, and I can help you get there in time for U.S. Open starting next week, or maybe early next week we can get you on there, all right? So go ahead and take a look. Make sure you're on playtennis.com and get yourself in that game, all right? Now, I have new contact information. You can email me at infinitetennis8@gmail.com, infinitetennis8@gmail.com, or infinitetennis8 on Twitter. All right, so thanks for listening. And have a wonderful whatever you're doing.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.